This is the Power 98.7 Podcast. Now we're talking. Subscribe to Power 98.7 Podcasts in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. There's more on power987.co.za.
It is 8 minutes after 10 o'clock and this is the second hour of Power Talk. I've got some stellar guests for us on the Thought Council today. Let me just quickly tell you who they are. Ntabiseng Moleko is with us, Commissioner at the Commission for Gender Equality. Of course, we'll talk about some of the harrowing stories we heard at the Gender Summit yesterday. This follows, of course, that prolific total shutdown march in which a number of demands are made of the president. He seems to have listened. We had that summit yesterday, and we'll find out what the outcomes were of that process. And Ndayedzo Ntonje is our Power reporter, senior reporter here at Power. Joining us on the line, Karen Morn, legal journalist at Tiso Black Star, and Sam Sol, journalist and managing partner of the Amabungane Center for Investigative Journalism. It is Friday. It is 10 o'clock. You know what time it is. Well, we ain't got no time for, the process of waiting for what will happen on the future of Malusi Gigaba. I know he's been summoned to Parliament. We've seen overnight tax box Tom Moyane also being axed, losing his position, and a number of calls made for the president to act swiftly on other people in government. Of course, people like Nomgcobo Jiba also suspended. What is to happen with Malusi Gigaba? My line is sounding very strange suddenly, Owen. I don't know what you have done, but welcome to all of my guests. Thank you very much for being with us. I think that an opener, an appropriate opener, which kind of comes out of the open line this morning, is to talk about what's happening right now as we speak at the South Gauteng High Court. Lerato Sengadi going to court to try and have the funeral of HHP Jabba halted. It's set to take place in Mahikeng tomorrow. And it raises all sorts of issues around the validity of the Lebola process if it is not complete in the way that it has been prescribed. You heard some of our experts on the open line share their point of view, and maybe we can get a position from the Commission for Gender Equality on this one. Ntabiseng Moleko, I know you're shaking your head and you're going, why? But maybe just a point even on, the vulnerability of women's positions. I know, Ndayedzo, you have a personal experience of this in your family as well. Maybe we can take those two points really quickly.
Thanks, Iman. Thanks. Morning to all your listeners. Listen, we don't have an official position as yet. So I think what I would say is that in times of burials, I think women are really vulnerable, particularly if families have different views of how burial must take place and who must take responsibility of location and the manner in which burials do take place. So I think we are watching what is happening, and I do think that before I do make an official statement on CG, we do have general position to say where women have rights violated and they are vulnerable, we must look at protecting those rights and ensuring that their voices are heard in such matters.
I mean, it's interesting that you said, we were talking offline just now, Ndayedzo, that the trigger for, in other words, a trigger of credibility or the trigger for the acceptance of the validity of a marriage contract in this context is even a small or nominal payment, and you have experience of this.
Yeah, it was quite a painful experience because it was my mother that had passed on, and unfortunately her passing on happened after my mom got into an accident while driving with my dad, and my dad was in a coma in hospital. So the families were deciding on where she needed to be buried, and my maternal side of my mother's family wanted her to be buried where she was born, as opposed to her being buried where she had been married, which is from at my mother my father's side. And ultimately what it boiled down to, I had to go and take word from my dad, and that was the matter that stood. My dad's word was that she needed her to be buried where she was born, where she was married, and the decision then lay with me, and I decided that my dad's
decision
was final. And upon sort of legal advice and also consulting, we had elect to stand on. It's a painful but process, but it needed to be done that way.
I'm so sorry to hear of all of that. It would have been hugely traumatic and emotional as you're grieving and having to make these decisions. Mm-hmm. I think we'll do another refresh segment on our rights and responsibilities in the arena of customary law and the factors that the court has to consider in making a determination on the survivor, it could be a man or a woman's marital status, especially when there might have been an aspect of separation or disillusionment or whatever, time away from each other in a context like this. So we would have also seen over the last 24 hours or so the results of an Amabungane FM investigation, financial maid investigation, confirming some disturbing things around former Steinhoff CEO Markus Jürster and some secret stakes in companies that had traded with Steinhoff for years that he benefited from covertly. And the true beneficiaries of these deals were hidden from investors. And you heard in that first tranche of hearings in Parliament around the goings-on at Steinhoff, the board members saying they were simply in the dark about what happened. They had also trusted the auditing firm, some of which had been in place for a decade or more, to run the affairs of the organization, and then were completely surprised by how things ultimately evolved and developed to the point where Steinhoff sustained those massive damages and a plunging in their share price. I think before we bring Sam Soul in on this one is to bring is to play you this clip, and you'll hear the voice of Craig McCoon, who's also a collaborator on the story.
Good afternoon, everyone. Hello from a chilly Oslo in Norway. I am Craig McCoon. I worked with Warren Thompson on our Steinhoff investigation. I wanted to give an explanation for how we sourced our information on the story, because I think it's quite a nice example of how hypothesis building and hypothesis testing can work in investigative journalism. So, finding sources. Sometimes you get lucky. Mostly it doesn't work that way. Mostly it's a process of careful, targeted work. And that involves building a sound hypothesis on the basis of good factual information and then testing it. A few months ago, I think it was about 5 months ago, we had four main facts broadly. One was Alan Evans from Jersey, a man who sat on the opposite side of the deal table from Steinhoff in a number of deals that were very suspicious and were at the heart of what appeared to be fraud at the company. Secondly, Warren and others investigated and exposed some very compelling evidence that suggested that another British man called Malcolm King held financial interests on Markus Jürster's behalf. For example, two properties in South Africa. Thirdly, a very helpful financial analyst with an anonymous Twitter account called JSE Dog unpacked a series of relationships and a series of company ownership transfers around a Bahamas company called Alverglen Estates. Now, he picked up that information from the structured data of the Panama Papers, which is publicly available, but he didn't have the underlying documents. And I thought what he had laid out on Twitter was very, very compelling. And then fourthly, Warren and an Australian journalist at the Australian Financial Review, Johnny Shapiro, did some sterling work on how Alan Evans and Malcolm King were involved in companies that had invested in furniture companies on stock exchanges in Australia and Britain. And not long after that, Steinhoff swooped in and bought out those companies, apparently benefiting King and Evans. What luck. Okay, so what was our hypothesis based on that? Very simply, that Malcolm King and George Alan Evans were bagmen for Markus Jürster and other insiders at Steinhoff. So we set out to test this. The first thing we did was we dug deep into the Panama Papers and the underlying documents, the emails, the company records. We saved everything. It took us weeks, I think even about two months of probing every angle we could find in there as deeply as possible. And secondly, and simultaneously, we matched those findings with public information. We were looking at news reports, company press releases, audited financial statements, and so on. Thirdly, and also simultaneously, along the way, we identified who potential sources might be. Who were the people who were close enough to these events to be able to help unlock them for us, because the data held in the Panama Papers and also the publicly available information were helpful but circumstantial and, you know, not vivid enough to tell a story. So we kept a list of potential people, and along the way we started reaching out to all of them. We also did a crowdsourcing campaign, just simply using Twitter. We put out some teasers of things, facts, documents, thoughts, suspicions, and so on that we'd found, and that brought in an unprecedented response. I've never done that before, and it worked really, really well. There was a lot of interest, and some really, really helpful people came out of the woodwork with some critical information for us.
So that isn't the entire piece, but I think, Sam Saul, we can come out of it there with Mark McCuney giving us the background as to how some of these central figures in this empire or this network of Marcus Eustace, the allegations of him keeping secret, you know, certain transactions and deals which would benefit him solely. Maybe just take us through, after this process was triggered by your investigative team, what the key tenets of their findings were in this investigation.
Okay, look, yeah, so from a bird's eye view, the key, as Craig said, you know, the key people that we identified as you know, being suspicious in terms of their relationship with USA, was this guy Alan Evans, and also another businessman, Malcolm King. Alan Evans ran a sort of trust company in Jersey, which set up these opaque offshore structures. Our breakthrough really was to be able to show that there was a company set up by Evans called Dainsfort Investments, and that actually represented USA's interests. And another company called Jamison Overseas, which was also brought under Evans's kind of protection, his cover, which belonged to the Steinhoff family. Now, nobody knew this. So what we could see was that Steinhoff, in various ways, was doing deals with companies that were controlled by these two people. And obviously, on the one side, was Steinhoff and Marcus Eustace and the Steinhoff family, etc., purportedly representing the interests of Steinhoff, the company. And on the other side, secretly, they were also on the other side of the table. So they were self-dealing, as it's called. And we've been able to show this, not, you know, across the board, but in some key examples, to show this was the modus operandi. It's important also to say that this goes back years. You know, this started at the end of the 90s, in the early 2000s, etc. The trail of evidence that we had went a bit cold later on towards the end of the 2000s. But we can see that this whole Steinhoff business was set up in a very questionable way right from the beginning, and we can extrapolate that some of the reason for the collapse is the kind of black holes that were built via structures similar to this.
So the architecture seems quite insidious, quite deep, and actually quite defined and targeted. You know, when I remember how Christo Visser was, you know, sitting at that initial parliamentary hearing, you know, talking about being ignorant of some of the things that were happening in the organization, some of the Trojan horsing that was happening on the auditing side, the kind of trust that they had in the process, and feeling, you know, sharing with us a kind of sense of betrayal. Would you say he was justified in that, given, as you say, Marcus Eustace kind of carried on this, you know, shadow empire under the marquee of Steinhoff?
Look, you know, it's very difficult for us sitting on the outside to say one way or the other, because we can't say what those people knew. What we can say is that, you know, for instance, Craig mentioned that, you know, there were very strong suspicions raised in the Australian media going back a few years about a particular takeover that Steinhoff did with an Australian company called the Freedom Group. So the Australian media raised question marks about these guys, King and Evans, who kind of bought shares, and that's what one might term as front running. They somehow bought shares in this company that then was bought out by Steinhoff, and obviously they made a good profit on that. And that's fine if you are basing your investment on clever understanding of the market or whatever. But what you can see is that, at least in some instances, they were representing Jurster. So he was on that other side of the transaction. So again, it's kind of an insider trading. There were all over the place, I think, red flags. And the board is really going to have to answer questions at some point about why all these red flags were ignored.
Sam Sol, thanks for that. I'm going to let you go. I'm going to release you, partly because the line is bad, but also partly because I'd like for us to pick up the story as our interest in Steinhoff seems to be eclipsed by what's happening at VBS and some of the other things, aspects or events around corruption, fraud, insider trading in our country come to light. I think it warrants a standalone session that really goes in, including those who are meant to be the watchers of how money moves in and out of our country. I think it is a wonderful story and a series of developments around which we can pivot that particular story. So thanks for stopping by and telling us about it. You can find the full piece online on the Financial Mail website as well to go into the detail of the special story that Amar Bongani has done, which really details Steinhoff's secret history and the dirty world of Markus Jurster. They put in a number of requests for him to answer questions specifically relating to these entities around people like Alan Evans and the other person that Sam mentioned, who I've just forgotten. Let me just try and find his name really quickly. You can find out more about how they are also key to this particular story and what role they played. And I think it's worth going back to. This is Malcolm King and George Alan Evans, how they're involved in this kind of shadow or parallel world in terms of investments and investment decisions that Steinhoff made with the authority of Markus Jurster. Karen Morn, I'm going to bring you into the panel this morning, and thank you very much for your time. This week was certainly bloody insofar as the world of or the criminal underworld is concerned, through the murder, the slick assassination of Pete Mihalik. And there have been a number of there's a lot of speculation around where this hit could have emanated from. We know that there have been some early arrests, but this is a story you know well, and I'd love for you to share with us your perspective, which kind of emanates from even the moment before those shots were fired.
Well, firstly, as a full disclosure, Pete Mihalik was a very good friend of mine. I knew him from about the age of 22 when I was a junior court reporter in Cape Town, and he was someone with whom I had a very long history, and you know, we often worked together on gang-related stories. So when I got the call just on about 8 o'clock that morning, it was actually from a mutual friend of ours who just said, you know, have you heard? And I was like, what? And he said, you know, Peter's dead, which was a huge, huge shock. I mean, Pete Mihalik had made his name by representing a number of so-called alleged gangsters in the Western Cape. He'd become an expert on particularly the Prevention of Organized Crime Act, poker, the attempts to kind of take down gangsterism within the Western Cape. But he was very proficient within his field, one of the best defense advocates in the Western Cape, a former prosecutor. And, you know, there were obviously a number of suspicions related to his death, which is clearly a hit. The individuals that have been arrested emanate from KwaZulu-Natal. My information is that they had no idea who Pete was. They were simply hired for the job by individuals within Cape Town. There will be a number of suspicions about why that happened, but it very much seems at this point to be a consequence of inter-gang rivalries in the Western Cape, with which Pete was believed to, you know, have become a target. Of course, you know, we know the state will make every effort to not just prosecute the trigger men in this particular case, but to get to the heart of what motivated them to do so. Tragically, Pete's little boy, who is 9 years old, was also shot during this attack, he has got a bullet lodged in his jaw, and it is completely miraculous that he was not killed. And my understanding is that the bullet came very close to hitting his carotid artery, which would have killed him. But, you know, my understanding is that the authorities here have surveillance footage, that they appear to have evidence of certain individuals actually doing a kind of dress rehearsal for the murder in the days before it was conducted, that they have footage of these guys pointing out Pete's route, where he took his child, where he would be. But I think that for me, the bigger issue outside the realm of obviously knowing Pete quite well and having been his friend, you know, gangsterism within the Western Cape has been a horrific aspect of life for the poorest of the poor for many years now. What we are increasingly seeing, which I think started with the murder of Nuruddin Hassan, who was actually Pete's attorney with whom he worked on another of these gang cases outside his home on the 7th of November 2016, is that this kind of aspect of violence, which has been inflicted on the poorest of poor in the Cape Flats, is now plunging itself into the heart of kind of privileged whiteness in Cape Town. We also saw a murder conducted in Pinelands in recent weeks, and I fear that this kind of bloodshed is going to only intensify as people potentially take vengeance or try and seek those responsible for this killing.
Well, Karen, I just want to convey, you know, my condolences to you. I know that you've taken it, you know, I mean, obviously it's been an impact to you and it had an impact on you, someone that you've known, you've worked with closely and whom you call a friend. So I'm really sorry for that. And I'm also, you know, hopeful that his son will be able to make a full recovery. Of course, the emotional trauma will stay behind. We know that his teenage daughter was also in the car. This has been a trauma for their entire family. And we want to find out more about these stories. We'll continue the conversation with Karen Morn and the rest of our Thought Council in just a moment. Let's go to Power News headlines and traffic. It is 10:30.
Thought Council with Iman Rapeti.
27 minutes to 11 o'clock. Not just me, Ntabiseng Moleko, Commissioner at the Commission for Gender Equality, and Ndayedzo Netonje, Senior Power News reporter, and Karen Morn, who is a Senior Legal Journalist at Tiso Blackstar. Thank you to all of you for being with me this morning. So we're looking at our television screens, right, and we're getting these constant updates from the union buildings. There is a march that is underway. And it is a march against e-tolls, amongst other things. But we were just commenting about how bizarre it is that, you know, it is the ANC in Gauteng that is marching and leading this march to the union buildings. You'd have seen a screenshot of Premier David Makura in there. The ANC marching on itself. We've said a lot about this kind of tugging cheek and on social media. But, you know, the irony cannot be lost on us, can it?
Listen, yesterday at the summit, it was a similar type of situation where most of the people speaking are the very people in charge, in the sense that they're saying that this is bad, reiterating what we already know in terms of stats on, you know, femicide, GBV, gender-based violence, and what's happening. And I think the issue is the very people who are having a problem or bemoaning the status quo have the power to change it. And I think that is where we need to, as you know, civil society and Chapter 9 institutions put pressure to say, listen, these are your responsibilities. This is what you have been put in place to actually change. You have the power. And so the resources are
They've
in your
the
hands.
They've got the power. But, but you know, again, it's a but situation.
Yeah, well, look, in defense a bit of the Gauteng ANC, when they came out of that conference earlier, and I think it's a battle of elections more than anything, they were clear that they want to retain Gauteng. And one of the things that national ANC and the government that have not been in agreement with is the issue of e-tolls. And I think they actually do mean well when it comes to e-tolls, but the motives are the ones that we need to question. Do you really need to win election to do this so that you win elections, or you just need to take the people's concerns to heart? And you don't really need too much. You can just speak to Cyril if you're the president, if you're the premier of Gauteng.
But Karen, I don't know if it's, you know, it's as incongruous to you as having a set of feet, and one is walking in one direction and others going in the other. The results can only be tragedy, really. You have Mboweni on e-toll saying that motorists must pay up; they can't expect anything for free. Then you have David Makura, who is basically saying that e-tolls are not a part of Gauteng's future.
I think it is a massive symptom of a party that is pretty much divided on kind of its economic policies, and that kind of incoherence, I think, has led to the president in many respects deferring anything that's politically contentious to commissions of inquiry, to kind of task teams, where it seems like issues like the PIC, SARS, tax administration, anything, even the state capture inquiry, which of course was ordered by a court, so it's slightly different. Anything that's contentious or going to split the party gets deferred to a different process, where essentially, in many respects, this country is being asked to be run by judges. And I don't know that that is particularly healthy for this democracy, but I don't know, in line of the fact that we have such a clear division within the ANC about what exactly its economic policies are, where is it exactly going in terms of where it wants to take the country economically, and how does this party actually take responsibility for decisions that, you know, your guests have rightly pointed out, it was in the midst of, it made itself. So there's no attempt to sort of turn around and talk about, well, you know, the marching ANC marching on itself really does not, I think, put major faith in the heart of the average South African. That the ANC are really, really leading a part in this respect.
Karen Morn, I'm also going to let you go and let you get on with your day. Thank you very much for stopping by and joining us. And as I said, all strength to you in the aftermath of Piet Mihalik's murder, his assassination, and hopefully the authorities will be able to define where this is coming from in a context where literally it seems as if they didn't know, because there's so many areas from which a threat could be coming or a hit could have been organized. And I'm so sorry to our listeners as well. I know that we wanted the full benefit of what Karen Morn is working on and some of the stories she's working on and her perspective on our topics on Thought Council. But the lines, as you can hear this morning, are just not playing ball with us, not our friends this morning. So I want to go back to the Agenda Summit yesterday. You know, I wasn't able to watch it live, but just looking at all of the stories that we heard from women who were victims, including women who are incarcerated, who were incarcerated for the murder of their partners, their lovers, or their spouses, the reaction in the room from others, which are saying, release her, let her go. And the call for the pardon, a presidential pardon or a blanket pardon on women who are incarcerated for the murder of their spouses in contexts where there have been proven histories of violence and abuse. That must have been a harrowing thing to watch and to listen firsthand, Ntabi Seng.
Yeah, so we were listening to about 10 different women who had different type of situations. So there was one with sex trafficking and the violation that happens in that instance, drugs being injected into her back of her knee at a young age, the betrayal that goes with that. There was another situation of, you know, a young woman who was fully able to walk prior to the event of her boyfriend or her partner stabbing her and stabbing her child 40 times, and she came in a wheelchair and she was paralyzed and she can only literally move portions of her upper body. It was, I can tell you, most of us were in tears. I think what is really, I think for me, important by the seeing the real accounts of the impact of that type of violence. You know, there was a young woman whose mother was murdered, you know, in this femicide issue, and how that has affected her and her family, her siblings. They had to raise themselves. They were orphans. So I think many of us read about these, you can theorize, but when you see individuals who are directly impacted by violence against their mothers, their sisters, you know, individually telling your own account of what has happened, the defeat they feel. And I think what was quite clear is a lot of women need healing. This is not spoken about. A lot of us are talking about criminal justice system. A lot of us are talking about processes that need to change with prosecution or the justice system. We'll complain about resourcing, budgeting these institutions, you know, all these things that need to happen. But I don't think there's anyone talking about what happens post, the trauma that they've gone through, the counseling that they still need. Where are the support mechanisms for that? And I think that was very clear to me.
You know, when you think about car accidents or things that happen on the road, and then you get, you know, you'd apply to the RAF and you would get some money which would relieve you through your convalescence, or if you're going to be permanently injured or disabled, that there is financial support for you. We don't have it in the arena of gender-based violence in our country.
And this, the thing with gender-based violence is that the effect is very long-term. So the psychological effects, and sometimes if you, for instance, are raped and you contract HIV, it has a long-term effect on your whole life. So what happens to you post that, you know, besides the psychological support, you actually need financial support because you have medical bills and all these medical things that you now must deal with that you wouldn't have had to deal with before. So I'm saying that we have never looked at it in that sense, in that how do we support women or people have been violated, even men in that instance, where there's violence against them, especially sexual violence and sexual assault, and putting money aside. I think the president was very clear to say resourcing has to happen. Gender budgeting must happen. We have had a lot of, you know, insistence as CGE on this, and I think we haven't really seen changes, and I think it's about efficiencies and promises really coming to the fore into actioning. I think that's what really must happen.
And it's a story which echoes so many other stories in our country in terms of Operation Fail. As Ntabi's telling us, you have the rulemakers, the gatekeepers, the key holders in the room lamenting about a problem, a tragedy in our society that they can do something about. You have the ANC admitting this week a 2 million from VBS flowed into its own coffers. Again, where were the checks and balances there? It's very hard in retrospect to have a kind of reactive outrage when you should have been keeping your eye on the ball. Do you know what I'm saying? How these things just come together. It's so incongruous.
And in actual fact, the past couple of months have just been a culmination of some of the wrong things that have been happening in society. And when you stand on the sidelines, you ask yourself, where has government been all this time? You look at, like Karen Moon was talking about, SARS, you look at VBS, you look at even societal issues like gender-based violence, and you sit and you ask yourself, where is the women's ministry in all of this? Where is...
Were they there yesterday, Ntabi?
No, they were. They had good representation. The minister was also there. Okay. Yeah, they were definitely present.
So the question that I'm asking is, where were they when these things are happening? I remember doing a story, and I think it was in April, sometime last year, between April and June last year. 60 women had been killed between that in that 2 months. There was just one, I think it happened a week ago, where
the burning by the boyfriend.
And you've got the Amutoso trial, and you've got all yesterday I was at the Dross rape trial, and you're just sitting and thinking, where's government in all of this?
I want to say, where's society?
Yeah.
Okay, so my view, and I think one of the views that we have, is, listen, this issue of gender-based violence is not because of government. The reason why women have to now be taken to court and supported by the government, and they have to be helped in all these instances of the different mechanisms that are there for them, we also assist where we can, is because of men and how men treat women. Rape doesn't come from government.
Yeah.
Men are the ones who rape women. They violate women. People who commit femicide, intimate partner killings, it's your partner, it's your husband, or it's your former boyfriend. You know, these things are happening between family members, incest, or a lot of molestation that we're seeing, the high rise of, you know, molestation is father, stepfather, happening under the guise of homes. I'm saying it's a societal issue, so we've got to look at mechanisms that are going to look at, you know, rebuilding, I think, the moral fabric of society, rebuilding families, rebuilding what is a father's role, you know, how are men supposed to treat women? What is this right that men seem to have, entitlement to women's bodies? Mm-hmm. You know, these are the things that we need to really talk about. And these are the things that need to change, because prevention is much more important than having now to deal with the repercussions.
But those things are intrinsically intertwined, because if the framework of enablement is not there in society, you know, we can demonstrate as much agency as we can in families. We can, we can demonstrate enough kind of over care in terms of the work that social welfare does. But as you say, the trigger for all of that is all the decisions that are made within a family. But what is the relationship between that and whether there is an enabling environment for us to be able to deal with it?
Absolutely.
I mean, women will go to the police station to lay a charge. They won't be listened to. They'll be turned back and sent home
yes.
to die, effectively, because that's what's happened.
Yes.
In a lot of these femicide cases, women have gone, they've raised their hands, they've told their families or they've told law enforcement, and they've been let down.
Absolutely. I think that's the case of Martha. So the point is that there's a double barrel approach that you have to look at. You've got to have, you know, a structure that enables you to actually see transformation where the source is. And I think that is important, in as much as looking at police stations. I mean, as a matter, case in point, rape kits. Are there rape kits at police stations, all police stations? How do policemen get sensitized, even policewomen, as to how to deal with rape victims? Is there a manner that they've been trained in, just through the process of being trained as a normal police officer? Probably not, because when you go into these situations and you hear the harrowing accounts of what people get asked, the questions they are, how their statements are taken, you know, the refusal to take statements and tell you to go back home, in issues of, you know, where you're beaten by your husband or partner, go and resolve the matter internally, go and try and solve this thing, man, you know, you don't have to go in terms of this approach. That is unacceptable. And I'm saying that I agree that there's got to be some level of transformation in terms of the procedure, you know, the attitudes, you know, of law enforcement officers in taking these statements, the manner in which they deal with the incumbents and those who are affected, and even the protection of perpetrators, I think, is something that we have to look at in the criminal justice system.
13 to the top. That's Ntabi Seng Moleko, and I've got Ndayedza Ntonje with me, taking your calls on 0861 987 000. Koketso's in Magaliesburg. Good morning.
Yeah, morning, Iman.
Welcome.
Yeah, morning, and morning to the guests. Yeah, Iman, I think for me, you know, the gender summit is actually one of the most useful summits we've had this entire year, in the sense that it gave a voice to the victims and allowed us to actually hear people's stories about what they've been through, you know. But I feel that these victims of this violence would get more sort of, I'd say, closure if they knew that the laws in this country would actually change, you know. I mean, it's within the president's powers and the cabinet minister's powers to literally, you know, for the president to literally assign people who are within the justice cluster to basically give them maybe a period of a year to review the necessary legislation that surrounds crimes of this nature, and then even actually look at adding minimum mandatory sentencing for people who are found guilty, you know. Up until, if nothing like to that effect, Iman, happens, then, to be honest, I just feel like it's just politicians paying lip service and using this summit as a campaigning tool. Because until we change the laws in this country where someone knows, if I rape this person and I am convicted, I will go to life in prison without parole. Mm. There is no, you know, this thing coming in front of the judge and us hearing mitigating sentences. Right now, we've got this gross rapist, Nicholas Nienau. It's another
alleged
situation where
we have to still say alleged, you know, even though, as you know, we heard the story play out in the way that it did, but it's got to go through the court process.
No,
go ahead.
I understand that, Iman, but that in there is also my problem as well, to say our law puts onus on the victim to prove this. So we need to look at this law and say, given the high rates of violence, particularly against women and children in the society, where I as a woman cannot go out for a run because I am worried someone will rape me. We need to look at to say, how do we then put the onus more on the person who they choose to prove their innocence, as opposed to actually putting it on the victim? I think this thing needs to be completely overhauled. And
okay, Coquette, I'm going to hold it there if you don't mind. It needs to be overhauled, as you say, and I think some of the points you've made quite well around what we do around reviewing legislation too. Walile is in Centurion. Good morning.
Good morning, madam. How are you?
Good, and you?
Yes. I watched the entire broadcast of the summit yesterday.
Yeah.
What I saw yesterday was a women abuse conference or a summit. That was not a gender summit. A gender summit should be inclusive, and it should also include men who are abused. Now, there's always this assumption that this is about women. Society has got issues, and society should deal with issues conclusively. There are also women out there who are abusing men and castrating them. No one is talking about that. Why is it that we always assume that men are always the guilty party here? It's a societal problem. Let's deal with the issues as they present themselves. Gender by design is inclusive. It is about society as a whole, both men and women. That's all I want to make an input for. Thank you very much.
All right, I'll get Ntabi to respond to that, and I'll make a comment on it as well. Mzwake is in Katlehong in Ekurhuleni. Good morning.
Good morning, Iman. There's this, and I think it's wrong, but there's this dominant perception that if you are part of the ANC or you're with the ANC, your right to petition the government has been taken away. You must go to an ANC branch somewhere and talk about ETOLs there, and that's it. Shut up after that. And I think it's wrong. If those in the ANC also feel that this is a very important issue for the people and they feel national government is not doing it, I don't see any contradiction there whatsoever. It is no different to the EFF going there. It is no different to the DA going there, because this is the government of the people. It's not a government of the ANC. Yes, Cyril Ramaphosa is from the party, the ANC, but he's the president of the country. And every person that thinks there's something to be sorted must go to Pretoria without being told who ANC is. Keep quiet.
Mzwake, thank you for those comments. In Katlehong in Ekurhuleni, in Daedzo.
Look, they're the policymakers, so they're marching against themselves. That you can't compare it with the EFF and the DA. I'm sorry, but they need to speak with one voice. And the ANC that we're seeing now is an ANC that it knows that society right now is not pleased with a lot of things, ETOs being one of them.
The thing for me that's stark is what it is for me is a show of a lack of confidence in government, right? Let's just say we don't know who the two parties are, but when people go out and protest, number one, they feel their agency is lost through the correct channels. They won't be heard. It won't find expression in the way that it should have to change the situation. So for me, it's a lack of belief in the government of the day. The second one is that it's showing signs of dissatisfaction again in the government of the day. The problem is that it is the government of the day whose supporters of the government of the day are carrying out a protest. So to me, it's just obvious. It's not about having the right to strike or being able to send a message. It is your party. It is your government.
Yeah, it's really, really confusing. If I remember very well, a couple of years ago, three or four, President Cyril Ramaphosa was the one that was leading some form of panel, which was dealing with the ETOLs. And now he's at the helm of government, and it appears that his administration is singing a different tune from what he was heading a couple of years ago, saying ETOLs were not feasible. And for Gauteng, the Gauteng province, which is seen to be in alliance with and in agreement with most of with the president, to be marching against him, it just also shows that this the ruling party, where it is right now, they're not finding common ground on some of the critical issues that affect society.
Okay, so critical issues that affect society, people would say that unfortunate video that we saw circulating earlier this week, which is a video about the private goings on of former finance minister Malusi Gigaba, should have nothing to do with people's opinions of his ability or inability to execute his job. Unfortunately, though, it has. I think it's been what would be the Latin word for a week? Because annus horribilis is for a year, a horrible year, a terrible year. Would this be a weakest horribilis? I don't know, for Malusi Gigaba, because the public protectors also found and confirmed that he broke his oath of office in terms of the whole Fireblade terminal that the Oppenheimers have at ORT. What should happen with him? I mean, the clock is ticking for the president to do something about it, especially in the aftermath of the axing of Tom Moyani. Which way do you think how many political lives do you think Malusi Gigaba has?
Look, I think one person that led by example, although it was under unfortunate circumstances, is finance minister, former finance minister Nhlanhla Nene. He knew when to leave the dance floor, especially when it was getting hot. And I think if you just touched on Tom Moyane, if you look at what the president has done, it's taken 8 months for him to get rid of Tom Moyane following due processes. And President Cyril Ramaphosa is that kind of person. Right now, it appears that there is grounds for him, President Cyril Ramaphosa, to say, now I'm getting rid of you, as opposed to what has been happening. There was no process that had, would, you know, put him in a corner and say, get rid of him. The Constitutional Court has now ruled against Gigaba. There's a public protector's report. That is enough to, for when you look at the caliber, the type of person President Cyril Ramaphosa is, where he first awaits for certain processes to happen, and Tom Moyane being a good example, before he takes action. And I don't think Malusi Gigaba will survive this one.
It's almost like, you know, if these processes like Nugent and so on were a backstop for the president, you know, it's my backstop. I got this, so now I can move. By the way, the Latin, so if we want to use annus horribilis, the Latin counterpart for week or horrible week would be ita sabbati. This was Malusi Gigaba's ita sabbati, and it's not yet over because it's only Friday, and ish, a lot happens on our weekend, man.
And then
a lot can happen.
And then there's the NEC is sitting this weekend, eh? By the way, executive committee.
You know, speaking of the NEC, I mean, they're obviously the highest decision-making body between conferences, and there's a lot of questions around the power of the Integrity Commission to make decisions around errant party deployees. And the concerns that the NEC might have, it would eclipse their own power. But we see this kind of pushback happening inside the party in terms of, you know, where ultimate decision making, or, you know, whether decisions of the Integrity Commission will be, you know, kind of supported by the NEC or even by individual members. And we saw this earlier this week with regard to former Northwest Premier Supra Mahumapelo.
You know, I was actually sitting this morning and looking at timelines and what and how the Cyril Ramaphosa led ANC has been handling things. And you had a divided ANC when he came in there. And you know, I remember that 10 days in February where it sort of, it looked like President Jacob Zuma was going nowhere, and then all of a sudden, boom. The same happened with Supra Mahumapelo. We waited for weeks and weeks, and the same now you see it happening with Tom Moyane. And if you look at the bull ring, you, those are the big guns that President Cyril
Ramaphosa, I like the way you put that, the bull ring.
Those are the big guns that Cyril Ramaphosa was faced with. And it looks like now the smaller fish, the ones that your Malusi Gigabas, your Thabile Dlaminis, are the ones that he needs to deal with. And I think that he sort of has got a grip within the NEC for things to sway his way if he managed to get rid of the likes of Tom Moyane, who, by the way, if you were to sit in that commission of inquiry, you would know that he's not an easy man to deal with.
Well, we don't even need to sit there. We can just look at what he's saying and the kind of war of paper that's being waged between his office or wherever he's operating from now and the presidency, right? Donald Mpahlele says the ANC is protesting against itself. It was their minister who said we must pay tolls. The key thing is they are electioneering. I'm waiting for a response as to why the office of the SG in the Thuli House approved the protest to go ahead. All right, power heroes and zeros. Who did you love this week? Who did you loathe?
Phew. It's a tough one, eh?
Yeah, so Mayor de Lille was in the news. South African unemployment would be my zero of the week. Unemployment numbers, which aren't looking good. And hopefully, you know, the investment summit together with the job summit translates into something really workable for our kind of erstwhile labor force in our country. The SABC is going to be restructuring as well.
That's my zero.
That's your zero? The SABC, who's your hero?
My hero should be, and it's because I've been sitting at the Commission of Inquiry, President Cyril Ramaphosa, for finally getting rid of Tom Moyane.
Okay, and Tabi?
My zero is the unemployment numbers. I think that we're at our lowest in terms of economically, and I think the confirmation is coming through with those stats. I think my hero for the week are the young women, the total shutdown. Mm. I think they've done a lot to get us to where we are. The fact that the summit is taking place, it's a summit, it could be a talk shop if we don't implement anything and we don't get any action plan actually actualized. So we want to see those things done. But I think those are my heroes for the week. The young woman who pushed for the total shutdown and have made a summit come to pass, because without them it wouldn't have happened.
Thank you so much for your perspective, Sam Sol, Karen Morn from earlier, and to those in my studio, Tabiseng Moloko and Ndayedzo Netonje. Thank you very much for your participation in Thought Council this week. It is 11 o'clock. It's time for Power News.
You've been listening to a Power 98.7 podcast. For more podcasts, visit power987.co.za or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.